It is a profound honor to share a stage with one of the most important scientists of our time. I am deeply honored to be here.
I'm deeply honored to be here with you, Jonah.
I thought I would begin the conversation at the beginning. You open your memoir, In Search of Memory, with a pretty amazing scene. You are just under 10 years old, and you're playing with a remote-controlled car, a toy car, and all of a sudden there's a knock on the door. And I wonder if you might tell us what happened after that. Who was knocking?
So the scene that Jonah is referring to was the scene that occurred at the time of Kristallnacht in November 1938. So Hitler came into Austria on March 13th, 1938, and within hours, none of my friends in school spoke to me. I was isolated from them. But an even more severe crisis happened at the evening of Kristallnacht, when police came to our door and told us we had a half an hour to pack our belongings. We had to move in with someone else whom we didn't know. They came on November 9th, which was 2 days after my birthday, November 7th. And I'd received from my parents' toy store this shiny blue car with remote control that I drove around the living room, and I enjoyed immensely. When we were allowed to come back to our apartment a week later, everything of value is gone, including my birthday car. And Clearly that was a memorable experience for me.
Painful. How long after that did your family emigrate to America?
We came in stages. So my brother and I left in April 1939, so 5 or 6 months after that episode. My parents came just as the war was breaking out in late August 1939. So we were able to escape, fortunately, without any bodily harm, but we came with absolutely nothing. And my brother and I crossed the Atlantic by ourselves. I still can't get over that. I worry when my granddaughter crosses the street by herself.
Do you remember what those first days, weeks, months in New York City were like living in?
I probably have an overly romantic view of it, because I had a very bourgeois Jewish existence in Vienna before Hitler came in, and I found it in retrospect to be comfortable but boring. Yeah. And there was something about the openness of American life that appealed to me tremendously. Now, obviously, I wanted to fit in. Every foreign kid wants to fit in. I wanted to speak English, and I picked up English quite rapidly. But the idea, I don't know whether this was your experience, but in Brooklyn, we played on the streets themselves. We played stickball in the streets. We did roller skating in the streets. And to have this freedom was extraordinary. So I got a lot of confidence out of being in America. And of course, I felt free from the anti-Semitism.
Yeah. And you were clearly an immensely successful student. You ended up at Harvard not so many years later as an undergrad. What was that experience like? Going from the mean streets of Brooklyn to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
That was one of the most remarkable experiences of my life, and it speaks to why America is such a magnificent country. I don't have to sell America in this context. But I, at Erasmus Hall High School, was a good student. I was particularly interested in history, and I wrote good essays. So one of the history teachers, Mr. Campana, approached me and asked me whether I wanted to go, whether I'd ever thought of going to Harvard. He said, where do you think of going to school? I said, Brooklyn College. He said, have you thought of Harvard? I said, no. And he suggested I apply to Harvard. I discussed it with my parents, and they didn't think this was a terribly necessary thing to do. They thought Brooklyn College was fine. And it also required additional money, small amount of money to apply. Campana said, here's the money. Why don't you apply anyway? Yeah. And I applied, and I was accepted. And by that time, we looked into Harvard, and we realized that, you know, it's probably as good as Brooklyn College. So I went to Harvard, and it was an eye-opening experience for me. Just an eye-opening experience.
What exactly was eye-opening? Just the intellectual atmosphere? I mean, did you know what you wanted to study at that point?
I wanted to do intellectual history, and I majored in a field called history and literature, and I wrote my dissertation on the response to National Socialism of three German writers. I just had a vague idea. I didn't have a very precise idea. I thought I wanted... Once I got to Harvard, I think the turning point was, God, being at a university is wonderful.
Yeah.
I want to be part of the fabric of a university. I never felt about that before. I didn't want to be a fabric of Erasmus. I loved Erasmus. I liked the girls. I liked the athletics. But I didn't want to be part of Erasmus. I wanted to be part of an experience like Harvard. And one of the reasons I like being at Columbia and teaching is because I really like what universities represent.
Just the pursuit of the mind.
The pursuit of questions of the mind. Yeah. And the freedom that you have. So I felt this. And also the variety of people that you interact with. I mean, my scope in Brooklyn was really pretty limited. The people that I knew shared pretty much my values and things like this. But to see kids from prep school, it came from very aristocratic backgrounds, to see kids from overseas, to interact with the faculty, extraordinary faculty in a new level, these were new experiences for me.
So how did you go at Harvard from being interested in intellectual history and German literature to then applying to med school? What was that? What led to that transition?
Love. I fell in love. That happens to people. So I fell in love with a wonderful Viennese woman who was a Radcliffe student, who was the daughter of two Viennese psychoanalysts. And I got very friendly with the two, with the parents. That was perhaps one of the problems in the relationship in the long run. I really liked parents a great deal. I'm joking. And Ernst Chris said to me, you know, you're not going to understand motivation by doing intellectual history. If you want to understand what happened in Europe, got to understand how the human mind works.
Now, at that time, I mean, you're a senior at Harvard. Were you really...
Junior
at Harvard. Was that really what you saw as your long-term intellectual goal, to understand, to kind of unpack?
I want to understand what happened to me. How could people switch so rapidly?
So that remained a very searing experience.
That's right. And Ernst, Chris, and Anna, in part, convinced me that to understand the human mind from an analytic point of view would be a deeper way than intellectual history. And I began to read Freud, and Freud is extremely persuasive and extremely effective and highly insightful. Mm-hmm. And so I decided in the spur of the moment that I would take a science course. I went to summer school at Harvard between my junior and senior year and took chemistry, which was I didn't enjoy very much, but I got through it. And in the senior year, I took the other required science courses, and I was accepted at NYU Medical School without having completed requirements on the commitment that they would not accept me until I'd finished all the science requirements.
And the goal was to go to med school to become
a psychoanalyst. And I fully intended to become a psychoanalyst, and I trained as a psychiatrist because I found it very hard to give up that aspiration. But in medical school, in my senior year, there was a six-month period in which you could do whatever you wanted to. And I thought that a psychoanalyst should know something about the brain. And there were very few people working
on the brain. What led you, if I could just interrupt you, what led you to have that conclusion? Because that was not an obvious thought to have.
That's a good question. The only thing I could say is that, it's coming back to me. There were two things. One is that I built a brain, as every student was asked to do, in my second year of medical school. A claim model of the brain. A teacher by the name of Mr. Hausman had this idea that it would be good for students to actually build a clay model with a way of remembering the anatomy. And I got a lot of pleasure out of doing that. And then I read in the Psychoanalytic Review two articles, one by Larry Kuby and the other by Mortimer Astow, who had become interested in Brenda Milner's work on memory storage. And I said, gee, there are analysts interested in the brain, so I should know something about the brain. That was the connection. And so I took this elective, and unlike my other science courses in which you read from textbooks, I found doing science so completely different. Well, you know what it was when we were working together. You know, you gossip, you talk about things, you examine the questions that you're probing, you criticize each other's thinking. It's a Talmudic experience. It's a completely different kind of thing than reading a textbook. And I like the physicality of doing experiments. So I realized science is very different than I thought.
Now, at that point in time, did you draw a stark contrast between these experiments you were doing in the lab and kind of the more theoretical nature of Freudian thought? I mean, did you see those as being in contradiction? Is there being a tension
not
there?
Not in any precise way, but I did have one general idea. And that is, as a result of my experience in medical school, I was selected for the NIH, which was a very privileged appointment. And at the NIH, which was a substitute for doing military service, my boss, who had recovered from schizophrenia, Wade Marshall, a fantastic man, had lost a lot of his zest for doing science, but was a wonderful mentor. And he essentially said, do whatever you like. I really didn't know very much to do what I like. So I thought, what would I like to do? What's the question that I could tackle most relevant to psychoanalysis? And I thought, memory. Brenda Milner had just shown the hippocampus was important for memory. We are who we are in large part of what we remember. And a psychotherapeutic experience is sitting with somebody who accepts you for what you are and recalling the traumatic effects of your life. You know, the blue card that was taken away from me, you're my therapist. Mm-hmm. And reliving those experiences. And so I thought I would tackle the problem of memory by studying the hippocampus. And I'd learned in Harry Grunfuss's laboratory how to put microelectrodes into single cells, which was a new technique which very few people had mastered.
And that allows you to measure the activity of
a single cell in the brain.
Of a single neuron.
And I and another young guy whom I convinced to work with me because I thought the problem was so interesting, Alden Spencer, a fantastic collaborator, he and I were the first people to record from individual cells in the hippocampus. And this was treated by our seniors as a spectacular advance. And we were very excited. We studied hippocampal neurons for a number of months. And then we sat back and said, what did we learn about memory? And we realized that we made a nice advance in cell biology. We did something which was a sort of a tour de force in terms of technical accomplishment. But insight, it gave us practically none. And so I realized one needed to take a reductionist approach. One needed not to tackle memory at its most grand level with the organ that's responsible for human memory, but look at simple forms of memory in very simple animals. And that led me to the marine snail aplysia.
Now, I mean, I think it's worth just pausing here for a second, because this is a deeply radical idea that we take for granted now. But at the time, the idea that you could understand human nature, you could understand human memory by poking a sea slug over and over again. I mean that was the basic idea that you could study a memory.
In all immodesty, one of the best scientific decisions I've ever made. And it was very intelligent, beyond my intelligence decision.
And what did people say, though, when you said you wanted
to study?
They were
very surprised. I mean, they thought I had a very promising career and that I was throwing it away.
And you were throwing away not just your career as a future psychoanalyst.
No. My scientific friends thought I was off to a terrific start.
Yeah.
That was one of the most exciting advances to come out of the NIH in the period that I was there in neurobiology. But I thought what I want to study is not the hippocampus as an end in itself, but as a hippocampus as it participates in memory storage, something that I can do now more successfully many, many years later. But at that time, it seemed impossible to do it. And the idea of going to a simple animal was, in a behavioral point of view, a radical view. In terms of the history of biology, which I was beginning to become familiar with, it wasn't a radical idea at all. The history of biology is to use the simplest possible experimental system to solve the largest possible problem. So you take a complex problem, you take a component of it that is tractable, and you study it in the simplest experimental system.
But this is the brain we're talking about here. This is the
one had
most
to
magnific-
have, I mean, one had to have the view that Darwin was right. Mm-hmm. That just as bodily form evolves, so does the mind evolve, so does the brain evolve. And if something is important, then learning and memory, you know, is likely to be present in all animals with the nervous system, then the mechanisms for memory were going to be preserved. And what you see in the snail was likely to be true in people. And that, in large part, has turned out to be the case.
Did anyone come close to making you wonder if this was a bad idea? Did anyone, you know, any of your bosses say there's no way you can learn about human memory from a...
Absolutely. John Eccles thought it was absurd, and he really thought I was throwing my career away. somehow my wife has been fantastically supportive of all of my inane ideas, thought this was great. And I was thought there might be a sort of a double motif. Denise is a French woman. She's born in Paris. And the only people who worked on this were in France. There were two people, Angelique Avanitaki, who worked, Charles Anaitis, who worked in Marseille, and Ladislav Tork, who worked in Paris. So we had them both for dinner. They both came to the NIH while I was working there, and we had a very pleasant evening. And after that, Denise, who had decided at time zero we would go to Paris, we went to Paris. And that turned out to be a very good move. She thought, Marseille is boring. She said, Marseille is like going to Albany.
And then what was it like? I mean, you know, so you've decided to study memory in a cell. At this point, you've given up on becoming a psychoanalyst, or that's still
not
a possibility.
Not quite. So let me just step back a little bit.
Yeah.
I had committed myself when I entered the NIH to do a residency in psychiatry at Harvard. My term at the NIH was 2 years. I found the work so fascinating, I didn't want to interrupt it. I called Dr. Ewald, who was the chairman of the department, and he graciously gave me another year so I could finish it up. When I got to Harvard, residency in those days was much easier than it is now. We had 9 to 5 working hours, and you know, an occasional weekend on duty. So I had a lot of free time. And Dr. Ewald arranged, after he got to know me, for me to have a lab. And I continued to do science while I was a resident. So my specialty was sticking cells, and I didn't have a plissy available. I worked in goldfish, and I was the first one to show that neuroendocrine cells in the hypothalamus, cells that release a hormone, also function like nerve cells. I could record the action potentials. They were not dramatically different from hippocampal neurons, et cetera.
Yeah.
And again, it was a nice experiment. To me, it was routine.
At that point, did you feel a big contrast between, on the one hand, treating patients and,
measuring individual neurons? The research, like psychotherapy, relaxing. Working with patients is hard. I enjoyed it. But it really is not as intellectually rewarding in some ways. It's a stupid way of putting it. It didn't give me the same pleasure as doing research.
At that point, had you started to question some of Freud's ideas?
I was less questioning of Freud's ideas than I was questioning of the next generation coming along that wasn't testing those ideas. And I was beginning to debate whether I should make science my full-time career. But I was very insecure about my scientific competence. I felt that the hippocampus was just a chance. You know, I just was lucky, you know. And what I was doing in the goldfish, which again was published in a very good journal, very highly accepted, same logic. It was really, to me, it was not original. I was just keeping my hands busy so I didn't lose any tactile skills. When I got to work on aplysia,
it's in Paris.
I began to see that I was good at this. And even when I came back...
And when you say good, are you primarily referring just to the manual labor of
recording
individual neurons or thinking about it as well?
I could have ideas.
Yeah.
The worry was not about the labor, because most people can learn the skills of doing science. You generate enough ideas to keep going. And after a while, and this was years after I started in aplysia, I still entertained the idea of continuing a psychiatry. But after, you know, I came back to Harvard, I was in the faculty for a couple of years. By the time I moved to NYU, I decided I'm going to do science all the time, and I'm not going to think about patients at all. Some of my supervisors thought I had clinical skills, and they thought that perhaps I should continue this. And I said, look, I can only do one thing well. And I'm, you know, who's going to see a psychiatrist who does this, you know, one day a week? You want to see somebody who sees patients a lot. And they suggested maybe I would specialize in hypnosis. You know, very few psychiatrists do that. Well, that's the least attractive aspect, you know, hypnotizing a patient. You don't talk to them very much. At least they don't talk back to you very much. And so that didn't appeal to me. So I decided I would do it. And that was an extremely wise decision.
How do you think having this training in psychoanalysis, having gone to med school, how do you think that informed your early forays into science and your early scientific career?
I think it's had a profound impact on me. I mean, you know, only somebody who really had a clinical background could see the importance of studying memory in a snail, because you see the things you're coming up with are going to be of general relevance. Also, I was not scared to tackle behavior. Lots of neurophysiologists felt, oh, behavior, my God, that's so complicated. I figured, you know, psychology have been studying behavior all along. You know, I've been studying behavior in people.
Yeah.
How can the behavior of the snail bother me? I learned how to do it. And so it didn't really bother me very much. So I had confidence to do this. And also sort of the overview, the kinds of problems I wanted to solve were related to the larger picture of the human mind.
Yeah.
So I always had the human mind as the target I wanted to address.
And in, even, I think, above that, were you still thinking about how to understand World War II, how to understand your... I mean, were those questions still at the kind of the back of your mind,
yes,
even as you were...
Yes, and throughout my career, I've written what I call pontificating papers on this. So when I was a resident, the great guru was a guy called Elwin Semrad. Elwin Semrad would interview patients, and it was as if the lights would go out, he would focus on the patient, there'd be an audience not quite as large as the one we have here, sitting around listening to him, and the patient would focus on him, and he would focus on the patient as if no one else was there. And the patient would remember that interview with Semrad 3 years later while they'd forgotten twice a week psychotherapy with you, okay? He made such an enormous impact. And he challenged the idea of doing science. And he tried to convince me to give up science. He said, there are two kinds of people, those that care about people and those that do research. Which side are you on? I said, I'm on both sides. And he had difficulty grasping that. When he died, to my amazement, I was asked to give the academic lecture in his honor. So I wrote a paper called Psychotherapy in the Single Synapse.
Wow.
At that time, a book had come out, which was called Sex and the Single Girl, so I really took off on that. And that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, in which I pointed out that we need to understand how psychotherapy works on a biological level. We need to understand it at the level of a single synapse.
Freud himself was actually, especially at the beginning...
Freud would have had no difficulty with any of this, but the contemporary psychoanalysts had no understanding. I said, look, insofar as psychotherapy works, and the changes persist over a period of time, they must be alterations in behavior like memory.
Yeah.
So you're producing alterations in the brain, and I was beginning to find that there were significant alterations that were occurring in the brain. So I suggested we begin looking for alterations in the brain that occur as a consequence of psychotherapy. And I've periodically written papers of this. And
what kind of feedback did you get from that first paper?
Negative.
Just people.
I mean, you know, the thoughtful people, you should excuse my saying that, immediately understood it.
Yeah.
But the analytic community, a large number of them have difficulty with this. Many years later, I wrote a paper modestly entitled A New Intellectual Framework for Psychiatry. And it got the largest response in the American Journal of Psychiatry than any paper published at that time had gotten. Not all of it positive.
Yeah.
The analytic community said that I didn't do justice to psychoanalysis. So I thought rather than answering individual letters, I would write another paper, which I called Biology and the Future of Psychoanalysis. And I said, look, if we want to read Freud as one of the great philosophers of mind, the way we read Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, we have no problems. He's going to be read forever. But if we want to use his insight as a basis for science, a therapeutic science that has shown its validity in experimental tests, then it's going to die unless we do that.
Yeah.
So we can have a hermeneutic point of view, in which case we don't have to worry, or we can have a scientific point of view in which you guys are losing out. You better do something about this. And I outline a series of areas in which one could test analytic ideas with biological approaches.
What do you think remain Freud's great insights that can be the basis of
this?
Well,
I mean, his greatest insight was that you and I function most of the time at an unconscious level. And that's a biological fact at this particular point. We're conscious of our conversation, but you know what you did yesterday and things like this, these are not immediately in our mind. So the narrowness of the conscious mind is absolutely right, that there are instincts for aggression and instincts for eros in us. I mean, we've seen all of that in our lifetime, that sexual interest occurs not after puberty, but is present very early. You can see this in the infant. I mean, these are rather profound insights, and that things don't occur by chance. There's a causal connection between the psychological events. I had an interesting discussion today with the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry here, who's a wonderful analytically oriented guy, very experimental, who sent by invitation a paper to the American Journal of Psychoanalysis, I guess that it was called, and they published this sort of a criticism of analytic thinking along the lines that I'm talking about. And they published this paper, but they forgot to list it in the table of contents. And we said to each other,
Freud,
the unconscious never lies.
Yes.
Freud would have been pleased with that, not with the fact that he was admitted. But, I mean, there are connections between events. So he had really a lot of insights.
Just even his emphasis on dreams, on how dreams aren't just
the noise in the machine.
He
realized that they have meaning,
they
represent
the
wish
day.
Fulfillments, and you can get at it, and that the dream really shows you how the mind works writ small, that you have an unconscious wish that you want to express, you censor it in various ways to make it socially acceptable, and if the censorship is not effective enough, it wakes you up in the middle of the night. These are, you know, the details may be incorrect, but the insights are very profound, and to begin to test it. So my thinking about psychoanalysis on two levels. One is independent of mechanism. One needs to show in a medically valid way that it works. That it works better than other forms of treatments under these conditions, works worse under other conditions. Under what circumstances you select a male therapist, under what circumstances a female, it doesn't matter. So one is efficacy, and the other is mechanism. And there are there's some biological markers for depression, for obsessive compulsive neurosis, and people actually have shown with cognitive behavior therapy that you can reverse those abnormalities successfully with psychotherapy. So I think the question is not, is there likely to be merit in it? But how do we optimize the situation so we understand what is meritorious and what is not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to forget that even in this age of amazing technologies, talk therapy remains as effective as any of the treatment out there.
If you were to make a survey, you would find that a significant number of people in the audience have had exposure to talk therapy. And if you speak to people who've had serious illnesses, Kate Jameson, perfect example. She almost committed suicide when she was very depressed, in a manic depressive illness. She said if it wasn't for lithium, she would be dead. But her psychotherapy was what gave meaning to her life. It stitched the whole thing together. And I think this is absolutely, it's wonderful to have the privilege of interacting with another person in this way. So to me, there's a lot of aesthetic value, intellectual value to it, but one needs to work in order to show the validity in which it's most effective.
Now, if we could just go back to Paris, and you've got these sea slugs, and you're trying to study memory in them, how do you go about studying memory in
aplesia? I was very much influenced by people like Pavlov and Thorndike, the people who really pioneered psychology by showing that you can study learning of simple reflex behaviors. So I selected a reflex.
So this is like you ring the bell and the dog drools.
That's
kind of
right. So Pavlov used a stimulus that always evokes a response in the animal. We call that unconditioned stimulus. And he used food, which invariably invoked salivation in the dog. And he used a bell, which did nothing when presented by itself. But if you present bell food, the bell comes to predict the food. So after a while, you don't have to give the food. The animal will salivate to the bell. Okay. So the animal learns that this predicts the food. So I wanted to do stuff like this. And I took very simple forms of learning, habituation, sensitization, classical conditioning, and I studied them in a very simple reflex withdrawal response. And I could show that the snail shows these forms of learning.
And so basically, this is just you poke the snail until
right.
it gets bored by the poking.
That's right. So one thing is habituation. If you poke the snail at a certain spot, it withdraws its gill, its respiratory organ. But if you poke it weakly, the first response is brisk, the second response is brisk, but the third and fourth response to the stimulus gets progressively weaker because the animal says, this is a trivial stimulus, why should I pay attention to this? Now, this is important to snails, it's even more important to Jonah Lehrer and Eric Kandel. In our lives, we're inundated with stimuli. We have to learn to ignore most of them so we can do our day's work. So habituation is a universal feature. I found when you study habituation in the nervous system, that the point of contact between nerve cells, where nerve cells talk with one another, synapses weaken. And if you just give a few pokes like this, you get a short-term memory, you get a functional weakening.
Yeah.
But if you do this repeatedly, you get a weakening that persists for very long periods of time.
Wow.
And we looked anatomically, we saw a disappearance of connections. So a third of the connections disappeared. Yeah. And as the animal lost the memory, those connections came back. We then looked at a more complex form of learning, sensitization, a form of learned fear in which we scared the hell out of the animal. Now a weak stimulus, which normally produced a brisk withdrawal, would do a fantastic withdrawal. And again, the animal would remember that noxious stimulus and give a tremendous withdrawal to a weak tactile stimulus for hours to weeks, depending upon number of training trials.
So for the first time, you'd really begun to show how a memory we can see manifested as a behavior, even if it's just a aplasia, getting bored by poking, led to real physical changes, a changed physical connection between two brain cells.
That's right.
What did people say? I mean, did people say, that's not a memory, that's just a reflex, or...
It's true. At the beginning, people said, it is just reflex behavior. And they didn't like the idea of using memory for that. But then as other people began to study other... So a number of people began to get into simple animals and behavior. Seymour Benzer began to do this in flies. Other people began to do it in other simple animals. So sort of a whole tradition began to develop in that. And people began to be more comfortable with using it for memory storage.
Yeah, you know, I mean, now it's the foundation of modern neurosciences from
It's a contribution, yes.
Well, I mean, the idea that human nature is too messy and too complicated.
Absolutely.
That
you can study behavior in elementary forms is now a standard idea, absolutely central idea to neuroscience.
When did you actually begin to realize that this insight you had, that you can study human memory in aplasia, in this very simple invertebrate, would actually pay off? That you would see the same fundamental processes conserved in invertebrates and the human brain.
Even before that, in 1970, we published three papers back-to-back in Science. One couldn't do that nowadays, but which spelled out the whole early strategy in aplasia, including the successful recording from cells, the behavior, the successful recording from cells, and the analysis of what was going on in non-biochemical terms. And that got a wonderful response. I then began to collaborate with Jimmy Schwartz, and we worked out the mechanisms that were involved, the biochemical mechanisms, and then with Craig Bailey to work out anatomical mechanisms. And by that time, this was really beginning to be recognized in a broader sense, and other people began to do very similar kinds of experiments. And it was very interesting because early on, I found that a particular signaling system that was involved, the cyclic AMP signaling system, was able to turn on long-term memory by turning on genes, and we could identify a particular switch called CREB, cyclic AMP response element, binding protein. There was a disease in people called Rubinstein-Tabe syndrome that led to mental retardation, and those kids lacked a part of the switch. Mm-hmm. So that made me realize that this is likely to be a very general mechanism. And when we got to mice in the 1990s, these mechanisms turn out to be very, very similar in the mouse, mammalian brain.
I mean, there is, just to be completely honest about it, there's something a little deflating about this idea, though, that the human mind, this Promethean gift, is really just made out of a bunch of used parts that you can find in sea slugs and mice and fruit flies.
You've got to blame that on Charles Darwin. This is not my not my work. But, Charles Darwin had this brilliant insight that there is evolution of species and survival of the fittest. And that means that once biology has found a mechanism that works, it uses it time and time again. It throws away things that don't work. It holds on to things that work. The genetic code, it's universal. I mean, that's much more fundamental than learning and memory. These things are preserved, and they have been the mainstay. This is how biology has progressed. We worked out lots of the molecular mechanisms for gene regulation in viruses and bacteria. I mean, you know, the structure of DNA came out of that. So in many areas of biology, this was routine. Mm-hmm. To apply it to behavior took a bit of a stretch, but why is behavior any different? Darwin treated behavior, you know, expression of emotions in animal and man, he treated it.
I just think we think of ourselves as very special. We're conscious, we have language. And to think about all these astonishing gifts, you know, being inseparable from these used parts that you can study, you know, in just about any creature out there
No question we've added on layers of complexity in the human mind that animal mind lacks, but there's a lot of stuff we share with animals. Sex, aggression, emotion, you know, intelligence, decision making, learning. I mean, these things, you know, animals are good learners. They learn what to approach, what to avoid. They're awfully good at this stuff.
Has modern neuroscience begun to identify what makes us so special? What parts you can't study in, you know, even old world primates?
Well, certainly language is a special thing. There probably are gestural languages in monkeys that have great communicative capabilities, but the ability to articulate speech, to write it down, has given rise to culture. We now have in parallel with biological evolution, cultural evolution. Yeah. We have textbooks that we can go back and read that are several thousand years based on, you know, ideas that are several thousand years old.
But even a talent like memory, human memory, this rich set of memories I have in my head, memories from childhood, memories you have from playing with a toy car before the Nazi policeman knocked on the door, that those memories are made out of the exact same stuff, or just about the exact same stuff, as that sea slug withdrawing from your poking. I mean, that's an idea that still shocks me when I say it out loud. Just it strikes me as my memories feel profound. They feel like little novels kind of woven into my mind, and yet they're made out of just flickering chemicals and...
Well, we don't know. Maybe the snail feels exactly the same way, just doesn't tell anybody. I mean, we just don't have access.
I would sometimes have that worry working in your lab. All the poor snails I felt like I was torturing, and I sometimes wondered if there was just a smidgen of consciousness there.
You know, consciousness is something we're aware of in ourselves because we communicate to each other about this. But I think it's unlikely that consciousness evolved in one fell swoop in human beings. It's likely to be present in primates. You certainly see awareness, intelligent inventiveness in monkeys. So you know the very famous experiment in which a monkey, in order to be able to reach an apple, had to put two sticks together so the stick would be long enough in order to reach it. So, I mean, you know, animals are very thoughtful creatures.
But just at the heart of, I think, your great insight that you can study memory in a place, you can study, you know, this fundamental feature of human nature in an invertebrate, is this larger notion that it really is a continuum. Like you said, the consciousness isn't just a phase transition. It's not from nothing and then us. That really, when you ask any question on human nature, it really is just part of a long biological continuum.
I think that's true. The one quantum step is culture.
Yeah.
You don't have monkeys creating art. You don't have monkeys writing, Proust was a neuroscientist. I mean, a monkey may have written it. But you know what I mean.
Yes. So then are we talking about creativity? Is creativity what really makes us unique?
No. I think it's quite possible that animals can be creative, but they can't put it in the context where be propagated from generation to generation. They have to rely on sperm and the egg to propagate anything from generation to generation. We can use the product of our intellect. We can publish it, we can paint it, we can do things with it that carries on from generation. So there's another way of really reproducing oneself that didn't exist before. This is a dramatic change. This is a quantal step that differentiates us. And it derives importantly from language.
That's interesting to think about. Really, our unique talent has nothing to do, or, well, I mean, it clearly is rooted in here, but in the end, we've got an external means of storage.
A lot of the things that we think are unique to people, you can demonstrate in animals. Yeah. What you can't demonstrate in them is the capability of building a civilization.
Yeah. Just to cut to 2011, what's the most exciting thing you're working on in your lab right now? I mean, I think it's important. You've still got an army of postdocs.
I'm working. The most exciting thing is the thing you were involved with Cal6C. So I have been interested in, through Cal6's presence in asking the question, how is a memory perpetuated for the lifetime of an individual? How do I remember my first love experience forever?
Yeah.
And that's true, I presume, for all of us. And Cal6, when he was in my lab, found a protein that regulates local protein synthesis. Turns out that synapses have a small machine for locally translating messenger RNAs. That's called local protein synthesis. And the molecule that regulates that is self-perpetuating. Now, self-perpetuating molecules have been known before. Stanley Prusiner described a self-perpetuating molecule, which causes... It's called a prion, which causes...
It's not a good thing.
Pardon?
Yeah, I think most people's association with prions are they're scary things. Scary things, mad cow disease.
Terrible neurological diseases, mad cow disease, all of these things, horrible. Cal6, when he was in my lab, found that a protein that can be self-perpetuating can be beneficial, and it can carry memory for an indefinite period of time.
I mean, you know, it's a wonderfully elegant idea because on the one hand, it does explain why our memories persist for so long, even when they're not reinforced. I mean, to use the great example of Proust remembered all his childhood memories, even though he hadn't thought about them for decades and decades. So what feels so attractive to me about this model is the fact that it begins to explain a very peculiar aspect of human memory.
Absolutely. So Cal6 is now studying this in flies and we're studying this in mice. We found a homolog in mice, and it's still early days, but we think it functions very similarly to the protein that Cal6 and I studied in aplysia. And so self-perpetuation is a thing that really intrigues me, how that works. How is an explosive event like this regulated? Presumably has things that turn it on, and that can shut it off if necessary. So those are the things that I'm looking at. I'm also, in part because I think life is a circle, returning to some of my early interests, I'm studying memory defects associated with psychiatric disorders. Particularly, I'm looking at working memory in schizophrenia, trying to develop animal models of that.
And you're also writing another book, which also has some themes from Vienna and art, just in terms of coming full circle.
I had a kid in my lab by the name of Jonah Lehrer. And he a pretty bright kid, good cook also. And you worked as a pastry chef or something like that at Le Bernardin?
I was a line cook, just a little manual labor.
We once had a party at my house, and you helped prepare the hors d'oeuvres. So you wrote a book called Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and you had the wonderful insight that great writers... Great artists study human nature. They understand how the mind works from a different perspective. And I was struck in looking at Austrian art, which I like a great deal, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele.
Is it something you'd always loved?
I'd always loved it, yeah. One of the earliest things that we bought was a Kokoschka lithograph that I like a great deal, Trudy.
What do you think spoke to you about...
What it spoke to me about?
Yeah, what spoke to you about Schiele and Klimt? I mean, you write beautifully in your new book about it. I'm just curious why you think you've always loved them, why they've always spoken to you. Is it Vienna?
I begin my book with a conversation between Rodin and Klimt. Rodin came to Vienna, and Bertha Zuckerkandel, who was a great hostess, invited him to lunch together with Klimt, and so there were some attractive women there, and Klimt asked a friend of his who's a pianist to play some Schubert. So there's this Schubert music, these attractive women, and Rodin is looking at the women with interest, and he turns to Klimt and he said, "I've never been in an environment like this before. This atmosphere, your work, Klimt's work, these beautiful women, this music, what explains this?" And Klimt nodded his beautiful head and he leaned over to Rodin and he said, "Austria." And this delusional belief about Austria, which bears no relationship to reality, is still ingrained in my mind. And I'm working this through. Mm-hmm. And I like Austrian art a great deal. I love Austrian culture. I'm taken with Vienna 1900, this period in which so many things came together. Freud's work, Mahler, phenomenal, Wittgenstein. It was an extraordinary period. So I began to think about how were unconscious mental processes thought of, how were they developed? Mm-hmm. And I realized that Freud was not alone, that his discoveries were shared independently mm-hmm. by Schnitzler, who was a writer, and by Klimt, Kokoschka, Schiele, and I point out what each of them contributed. And I also trace the fact that they were all influenced by a single source, who was a head of the Vienna School of Medicine, a guy called Karl von Rokitansky. And I use this metaphor sort of throughout the book, that there's an interaction between science and art in order to move things forward. Just to give you a simple example, Freud had a lot of insights into unconscious processes, but he didn't understand female sexuality at all. And he got that all wrong. But, you know, Schnitzler and Klimt, who slept with God knows how many women, a few thousand. In fact, Schnitzler recorded every orgasm that he ever had.
Wow.
It took three volumes to do this. And they obviously had more sexual experience than Freud had, so they knew a lot more about female sexuality. This is just to give you an example. Yeah. Also, Freud knew that aggression was important, but it wasn't until the First World War, that he put it on the same level with eros.
Yeah.
The artists knew that aggression and eroticism were on the same level from the beginning, and in many of their paintings, they really draw them together.
Do you see that time period perhaps as a model for how art and science can interact? Because you very much see the artists studying Freud, learning from Freud, weaving his insights into their paintings.
The interaction, this is the central point. I think science needs to be incorporated into culture as a daily activity. Just like people turn to the sports page, they ought to turn to the science page. Mm-hmm. It's part of intellectual life. In fact, I would argue that it's more important than sports. Not in this audience, but generally. That doesn't happen. It's not even happening here. I mean, Charlie Rose trying to do it. People are trying to do it. But and you and I are going to try to do this in the book that we do. But I think this needs to be done more. And Vienna did it. It had people talk to one another.
Yeah.
People didn't think that science is incomprehensible. It was part of dinner conversation.
Yeah.
So it turned out that Klimt was fascinated with biology. He attended a salon run by this woman, Bertha Zuckerkandel. Bertha Zuckerkandel's husband, Emil Zuckerkandel, was a colleague of Rokitansky. Hmm. And he got Klimt interested in biology, but Klimt insisted that Zuckerkandel come and lecture to other artists about this. And if you look at Klimt's paintings, you see biology is all over it.
Yeah.
So in The Kiss, for example, a man and woman are embracing. And she has a gown and he has a gown. If you look at her gown, it's got over. Mm-hmm. If you look at his gown, it has linear symbols, sperm. They're embracing together. This is a union. This is sexual intercourse writ large, right there.
So how can we do a better job of making 21st century science, which Freud had the advantage of writing a lot about sex, which I think translates well. But how can we do a better job of making 21st century science, things like CPB, things like CREB, things like gene expression, you know,
to
help them compete with the sports page?
To explain it in ways that are accessible to people and to point out what's really exciting about it. Why do you and I get turned on by something like this? And I think that's not easy to do, but you and I both enjoy doing it, and I think it needs to be done, not only by you and me, but by people who perhaps can do it better than we can. Subsequent generations. I think it's extremely important that science be communicated to the general public, that it be incorporated into the intellectual and cultural fabric of society.
Is there one discovery you think neuroscience is on the verge of making that will transform society, solve a big disease, cure drug addiction, come up with a way to treat Alzheimer's, that really excites you, that you think will be on the front page of newspapers sometime soon?
Yes, but I would go even a step beyond that. And Lee Bollinger, our president, has really had a sort of a wonderful insight. He's defined neuroscience as, you know, the area of science that he thinks is likely to be a powerful synthesizing force that brings the humanities and the sciences together.
The brain's such a great category buster. I mean, it brings together sociology and psychology.
Exactly.
Aesthetics and
the
philosophy.
The biology of mind is relevant to sociology, decision making. It's relevant to moral decision making. It's relevant to how you respond to a work of art, how the beholder views and emotionally responds to it. So in principle, Bollinger says, in a deeper sense, most of what we work on is concerned with mind. Mm-hmm. So understanding the biology of these processes could be sort of a bridge between the humanities and the sciences in a very profound way. And hopefully this will come.
Do you think one day neuroscience might even reveal that a lot of the academic distinctions we have right now...
Artificial.
Sociology and psychology are two sides of the same coin.
Absolutely. This has happened between psychology and brain science. Mm-hmm. They've fused together. Now, when they fuse together, people have the feeling that the biological component is going to be radically, eliminatively reductionist. They'll do away with psychology. That's nonsense. What biologists want to do is not do away with Pavlov and Thorndike. I didn't do away with... I want to understand what they were doing. It's a fusion.
It extends it.
Right. And same with psychoanalysis. You know, they're going to... Obviously, one hopes to rectify things that are wrong, but the edifice is not going to disappear. It's going to be a new kind of psychoanalysis.
What do you say when people push back, though, and say that if you, let's say aesthetics, let's say we're talking about art, and we can talk about art in terms of the visual cortex, in terms of the flooding of neurons somewhere back here, is something lost when that becomes the language with which we talk about why Klimt is beautiful?
Okay, so there are two answers to that. One is that as we get a biological understanding of how people respond to art, that doesn't change the way you respond to it. You know, it gives you additional insight into how this occurs, but you still have an emotional response. And when you have that emotional response, you don't think about, you know, what you read in your book or my book about it. You just respond to it. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, take the heart. Harvey, when he worked out the circulation of the blood, said, I feel very frightened. People think this is the seat of the soul, and I've shown it's a muscular pump that just pushes blood around the body.
Yeah.
And we now know that Harvey was absolutely right. It's a muscular pump. But do you feel any less awed by what your heart does? You still feel it's a wonderful organ.
But isn't there something a little bit different when we're talking about things like free will, and that now neuroscience, even just by talking about how important the unconscious is in terms of shaping behavior and decisions, has really chiseled away at the old Cartesian notion of... I mean, there's a difference between talking about...
Okay,
something.
So I think that's a beautiful example. Neurobiological studies have indicated that when I make a decision to pick up that glass of water, there is something that goes off in my brain before I make that decision that you could read, but I'm not aware of, that tells me that I want to pick up that glass
of water.
Which
strikes me as a pretty
There's
serious challenge.
There's an unconscious process that precedes my conscious decision making. So decision making has a preceding episode that's unconscious, okay? Does that affect my life? I still want to pick up this glass of water, right? Yeah. And I still want to drink it. So it's quite good, actually. So, I mean, it's as if it doesn't matter. I could get up from this chair and walk out of this room if I want to. I mean, what better example is there that in practice mm-hmm. I have free will? Do you see when that's a
absolutely.
Perfect example of how I feel and how I know need not necessarily interfere with one another when I feel something, you see?
But ideas about human nature also impact.
They impact also feed in the long run. We have a more realistic view of the nature of our control. Mm-hmm. But our unconscious is still part of us,
yeah.
you know? And that part of the unconscious is constantly in contact with consciousness, is being influenced by conscious processes.
And there's something, I think, a little beautiful, too, about thinking of ourselves as this weaving and unweaving loom, as Charrington put it. Just that we are a trillion synapses, and yet somehow we feel like you and me and this here now, we still have subjective reality, emerges somehow from just a lot of electricity, 12 watts of electricity. So there's something a little, I think one can make the romantic case for neuroscience as well.
I completely agree with you. I mean, to me, this is not a conflict. But, obviously people will react differently to it. I think as we become more comfortable with the facts of the brain, as we learn more about it, and we're at the beginning of really these deep understanding, we don't really understand consciousness in a profound level, people will become more comfortable in thinking about it that way.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a tremendous honor and pleasure for me. Thank you so much for sharing all your insights with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.